now, these, oil spills?
Those are the mics.
Okay, how does that work?
Good morning. It's Monday, the 25th of March, 1991. I'd like to call to order the House Special Committee on the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Claim Settlement. I note that we have the following members of the committee present. We have Representative Davidson, Representative Donnelly, Representative Navarre, and myself, Representative Gruenberg. We also have Representative Lehman, who's been regularly participating with us, and we hope to continue to do so. I'd like, first of all, I've already introduced to you our committee secretary, Pat Williams, who's over there in the red outfit recording, and I'd like to introduce to you our staff counsel, Andy Hemingway, who most of you know. He was one of the staff counsel for the Judiciary, Committee last 2 years in the 16th legislature. And we are online here. I neglected to put my toggle switch up. It's listen only. We'd like to welcome people here in Juneau in the audience and the people around the state. Again, this is listen only, and we will at a later date open this up for public testimony. We have again Ms. Pamela Finley, the Assistant Revisor of Statutes, and welcome to you, Ms. Finley. We're going to hopefully walk through the Memorandum of Agreement today and also the Plea Agreement, if we can get to it. In that sense, the agenda will be slightly amended because we're going to try to get to the Plea Agreement also. And then we will move ahead and invite the Attorney General and various other people to testify after that. I have questions from the committee. Representative Davidson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we get started, I was wondering if perhaps I couldn't, for the record, these are not vitamin pills. These are samples of crude oil taken off the Bay of Isles, or Night Island in Prince William Sound on March the 7th, so we're not talking very long ago. And I brought these just for the interest of the committee so that long term we can keep an attitude or an idea about how significant is the catastrophe still as far as areas in the Sound. So I thought you might be interested in passing that around to the community.
With that, what we'll do is pass it around to the committee and have it available for members of the public to look at, too. If they would return them, please, to Representative Davidson. I think that those are items that people in the legislature would be most interested in seeing. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other comments before we commence? We also have been joined by Representative Ulmer, another member of the committee, and I'd like to welcome her. With that, Ms. Finley, would you like to commence?
Today we're going to be discussing what I call the MOA, which is the document that says how the money is to be spent. And this is an agreement between the United States and the state of Alaska. Exxon doesn't have a part in this. I'm going to try to move fairly quickly through this because matters in the MOA have already been raised at different times as we've in previous hearings. However, please feel free to stop me anytime you feel I'm skipping over something that you're very interested in. The introduction just sets forth the background of the case, really. It also is a place where you can find out who the federal trustees are and the state trustees and the federal on-scene coordinator and state on-scene coordinator. It also sets out the laws on which the parties rely in coming to this agreement for this joint trust. I found it interesting that they did not reference some federal regulations that appear to me to be relevant, and that's something I'll get to a little bit later, and it's also something that you might want to ask the Attorney General about. The jurisdiction of the court here is the same as it is in the consent decree, including jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act. I'm not going to go through all the definitions, but maybe I'll just hit the highlights. When they refer to allowed expenses, those tend to be the reimbursements to the state and federal governments for past expenses of various types, on the state's part, litigation expenses. When they refer to natural resource damage recovery, that is essentially the money that's going to go in the trust fund. It's the full amount of the settlement less the allowed expenses, less any cleanup costs that the state or federal government after December 31st, 1990. So so that it's hard to say exactly what the natural resource damage recovery is going to be. Because actually, it's for two reasons. One, it's hard to say exactly how much Exxon is really going to be paying, since some of the $900 million that they're going to be paying is going to be deductions from that for their cleanup costs, and the amount of that is not too clear. Also, there are going to be deductions for future cleanup costs if the state or federal government do them. We do know that about $134 million will be returned to the various governments. So potentially, at least, I'd say the natural resource damage recovery, or the amount that will go in the trust fund to be controlled by the state and federal trustees, is probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $700 million. That's a rough guess, because it depends on a lot of deductions and things, but that in somewhere in that neighborhood, $700 to $750. It also defines the trustees as the current trustees and any replacements. It's important to notice that the people who get named as the trustees now will not necessarily be the trustees for the next 16 years, but the offices that get named as the trustees. Also, one of the important definitions, I think, is restore or restoration, because this is the limit on what the money can be spent for, what the trustees can do with that roughly $700 million. It's fairly general, not too specific about it. It's an act that endeavors to restore a natural resource or services provided by that resource that was injured, lost, or destroyed by the spill. It also includes actions that replace something, put in the instead of the damaged resources, something else, and the acquisition of equivalent resources or services. And I'll discuss that a little more fully, but I just point out that the definition here of restore and restoration is really just about the only limit on the amount, on what the trustees can spend the money for. The section covering co-trusteeship simply states that the trustees shall act as co-trustees in collecting and expending the trust fund money. To avoid the claim that this co-trusteeship would give one government ownership or authority over those natural resources, they state that nothing in the MOA shall be deemed an admission on that subject. So there's another interesting section later we'll get to, but it almost seems to undercut that. The section also states that the MOA does not affect the rights or obligations of third parties, or the rights and obligations of the U.S. or the state to native villages or to third parties. So this is essentially, we're dividing up our money, and we are not trying to divide up anybody else's money. The next section covers organization. All decisions relating to the use of this trust fund money.
Ms. Finley, before continuing farther, I'd like to note for the record, we've been joined by Representative Cabina and Representative Hudson, both members of the committee. I'd also like to make an announcement, a little bit out of order, but please give us your binders today immediately after the hearing. We'll update them and get them back to you hopefully by noon or early afternoon, so your binders are all up to date then. I'd just like to, the main reason I interrupted you was you're moving pretty fast. We have been joined by some new members here, and I'm wondering if anybody has any questions thus far, because you're getting into some very important areas. Does any member have any question thus far? I will have a question on organization, so I appreciate if you pause after that. Thank you.
Return there. In order to spend this, what I refer to as the trust fund money, the six trustees, the three federal and the three state trustees, have to agree unanimously as to how that money is to be spent. If they don't agree, then either government may resort to the federal district court in Alaska to settle the dispute. The trustees may also submit the matter to non-binding mediation or, quote, other means of conflict resolution, end quote. They agree to cooperate in establishing a joint trust fund in the registry of the federal court in Alaska, or otherwise, they may decide to put it somewhere else. But the initial agreement seems to be put it in the registry of the court. The trustees also agree that they will establish procedures for meaningful public participation, which may include a public advisory group, and that they shall agree within 30 days after the consent decree becomes effective to an organizational structure for decision-making. Now, I had some questions, or I think there's just some questions that arise naturally when you read this. The first one, big one, is why the state and federal governments did not separate the money recovered by the federal government from the money recovered by the state government. That's probably a question that the Attorney General will have to answer. But it is an important one because the Clean Water Act does not really require these commingling of state and federal assets. And it doesn't even really seem to provide for it or anticipate it. So it's an important question. Also, I had a question as to whether or not the establishment of a joint trust fund commingling the assets here is contrary to a section of the Clean Water Act, which is commonly known as the 311K fund. And that, it's actually 33 U.S.C. section 1321K, but it's also familiarly known as the 311K fund. And that requires the money received by the United States under this section, and the United States is suing under this section, to be deposited in a revolving fund in the federal treasury. And so while we have been looking at this a great deal from the point of view of state law, does this comply with state law, I think there's also a question out there, is does this comply with federal law? Because if it's not valid under federal law, then it doesn't really matter whether it's valid under state law, it's just not going to be valid. So that is a question that I had. There are also two regulations, 43 CFR 1192, which require the state's money to go to a separate account in the state treasury or to an interest-bearing account payable to the state trustee, and that also require the federal money to go to the into an account in the federal treasury. So that the federal law here, as I say, doesn't seem to anticipate this commingling of assets, and I'm wondering if it is valid under it. Also, there's a question in my mind as to whether or not the commingling of assets would violate the trustee's common law trust responsibilities. There's an issue there. Practical question as to whether or not a trust fund in the court registry is going to bear interest. That should be a fairly simple question to answer, but I have not yet answered it. The other question I had was what standards would a court use in deciding disputes among the trustees? Because it says that you may go to the court if you have a dispute, but what is the court really going to be looking at? On what basis are they going to be deciding the disputes? I think they might be able to decide whether or not one of the proposed uses was actually for restoration, because the MOA says it has to be used for restoration. But after that, I'm not sure what standards they would use. Think of yourself as a judge trying to settle this dispute. You're going to have to base it on some law or some agreement of the parties, and I'm not sure what it would be. I'm not sure what the court would use to decide that. And finally, since the trustees can agree to other forms of conflict resolution, would they be allowed to use binding arbitration such that you would have not just a federal judge deciding how the $700 million is being used, but an arbitrator, actually? So those are the questions that came to mind and that I think have been mentioned in earlier hearings that I tried to gather together under this section. Were there others?
Questions by other members of the committee, first of all. Yeah, I have one concern, and the concern is reflected in the agreement here that is on page 10 of the agreement, paragraph Roman numeral 4, capital A, Arabic 3. And I'll read it. If the trustees cannot reach a unanimous agreement on a decision pursuant to paragraph A1 of this article, and either government, that's emphasized by me, so certifies, either government may resort to litigation in the United States District Court for the District of Alaska with respect to such matter or dispute. And then it goes on to say the governments may at any time by mutual agreement submit such matter to non-binding mediation or other means of conflict resolution. But this would appear to set the federal district court for the District of Alaska as the tiebreaker here.
Yes.
Am I correct in that interpretation?
Yes, I think you are. And perhaps even more than a tiebreaker, it may be that you have three. It may be that they're saying that you can't even do something, that some of the trustees may say you can't do this and the under this law, under whatever applicable law is, and that federal court will actually be ultimately making the decision. But yes, certainly a tiebreaker.
Okay, that brings up several subsidiary issues just for the staff as they're making a list of issues, which I'd like them to do, continue doing. Number one, this sets a court of law as the final decision maker here. And the question to me, by me, is whether that's the proper role of a court of law, whether they are established and they're competent to make that kind of a decision. This is an executive decision, not normally the kind of case and controversy that a court of law would do. Secondly, is it appropriate for a federal agency, as opposed to a state agency, to make this decision from our point of view? And I have some questions about that as well. Third, because the court system of the federal court system is a court system of limited jurisdiction, only as set up by federal statute, is this allowable under federal statute? Is there a federal statute giving a court jurisdiction over a controversy like this, unless we agree that this is under federal law? And that in itself may be outcome determinative. Ms. Finley, do you have any comments on any of those?
Well, the only comment I would have is that this is going to be not just an agreement, but a consent decree. It's going to be a court order. And I think the court does have jurisdiction. The United States is a party, if nothing else. And there's also the Clean Water Act. I think the federal court does have jurisdiction over this. And then once it enters an order, it can probably make decisions as to whether or not its order is being complied with. That's the only comment I have, and I'm not saying that your questions are not very well taken. I think they are.
I understand, and just so the record is clear, that may limit the scope of the court's authority in this matter, which is only to determine whether, quote, its orders are being complied with. Mm-hmm. That may not be the issue at all that's before the court. And it talks about commencing litigation, which doesn't seem to be limited to enforcement motions or some motion in the case at bar. And the case, this case, as I understand it, is already assigned to Judge Holland. And if, in fact, that were to be filed, a subsequent motion in the case at bar, we know the assigned judge, and we know something now about the assigned judge and his actions last week, which the members, I think, are aware of. I'd like also to have the record reflect that we've been joined by Representative Finkelstein, who's been participating, and hope he will continue to do so also. Any other questions on that provision?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kabina.
Are we on teleconference?
Yes, we are. This is listen only. We will always be on teleconference. Listen only.
Mr. Chairman, could we go back to the definition section for a quick?
Certainly.
Pam, could you expand a little bit on your restore and restoration? And obviously, this seems like a real crux of the whole thing, where what the money can be spent on. Does this appear to you to be a rather broad definition so that they have a lot of leeway here? Or can you give me maybe some of your ideas of what their constraints really are with this definition?
It is a broad definition, and I think all I can say is that at this point is this is what I'm guessing a court will decide that it means if the question ever comes up. So it's not one of those, it's not a term, it's a term that has a meaning, certainly in the law, but it is not a really specific, narrow meaning. Perhaps since we are on teleconference, perhaps I should just read this section. Restore or restoration means any action, in addition to response and cleanup activities required or authorized by federal law, it's any action which endeavors to restore to their pre-spill condition any natural resources injured, lost, or destroyed as a result of the oil spill. I think there you're talking about fish rehabilitation, beach rehabilitation, sort of things, and the services provided by that resource, which has always struck me as a real something you need to be careful about, because services are not defined, and this is almost sort of sitting there in the cracks, but it's potentially a very important term. The services provided by the resource, that could mean, let's say, you use your beaches for beachcombing and recreation. That is a service provided by the resource. You're going to write off this beach and essentially say there's no hope of restoring it. We'll make some other recreational activity available to people. Would setting up a campsite come under this? A ski resort? A road to a ski resort? It's not quite clear where the limits end. It's actually not entirely clear what services means. I am pretty much relying on the federal regulation definition. There is a federal regulation definition of services, and it talks about the biological functions of these things, including human uses. So maybe you could stretch it to recreation, and maybe you could stretch equivalent natural equivalent services to things like ski resorts. Maybe, I don't know, but it's certainly out there as a possibility.
And then Pam,
it's really up to those six to make that determination what this really means in their own mind. And from there, it would be, if someone disagreed, they could file a suit, and then the judge would be the arbitrator of that decision.
Well, if one of the three trustees disagreed, he could file a suit.
But if the six.
Yes.
If the six decide, and I look at this six as really being two votes. I'm assuming the federal government is going to be lockstep, the state's going to be in step with each other. So really, you got two people that are going to make a decision. But if some outside party thought that their decision was wrong, a city, an entity, Native Village, anybody, then and they filed suit on how that money was being spent, the judge would be the arbitrator in essence of that?
Well, the judge would certainly be an arbitrator if a third party were able to file a lawsuit. And there's a question here that we get to a little bit later. There is a real question as to whether or not a third party can bring a lawsuit as to the interpretation of the law.
Before taking Representative Hudson's question, I just would like to remind the members of the committee and everyone else that, as a practical matter, I think that the only place we will be, the society will have a complete review of all of these agreements and a legislative history and a history is going to be through this committee. And that is why I am asking staff to be sure that we list all the issues and that we really establish as much as possible what these questions are and whether, if they are answerable, what the answers are. So do not hesitate to ask questions because this is the only place they'll be asked. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pam, and following on Representative Cabina's line of questioning there, it seems to me like this whole question of what are the operating standards had to exist in the minds of the three parties that came to the table and accepting this proposal. And it just seems to me like that's one of the very first things we ought to have is how do you interpret it, Exxon? How do you interpret it, Federal? How do you interpret it, Attorney General? Because we're sitting in here trying to figure out what was in their minds, and clearly they must have had something on their mind when they accepted this. And I think that would give us a lot of the answers that we're trying to pull out of between the white lines. Is that your understanding?
Yes, and I think that actually if you can get all the parties, parties to this particular agreement, which is the state and federal governments, if you can get them to say what they think the limits are on the record, then that's going to be very useful. This is an agreement. It's also going to be a consent decree, but I think probably if both of the parties are agreeing as to something, unless it's completely out of line, probably the court's going to follow along with it in that interpretation. So that would be very useful. I'm only raising the questions to start people thinking so that when you do get the Attorney General here, you can ask that question. I think it's definitely something that you need to ask the parties. Though I would point out also that there is a restoration plan in the Federal Register where they, I think, are suggesting some of the things they're thinking about doing for next year, and that is, as I remember, it's salmon enhancement and beach grass enhancement, fairly standard things.
Thanks.
Other questions? If not, please continue.
The next paragraph concerns retention of rights, and this is more of a little technical section, I would say. It says, first of all, the MOA does not prevent either government from undertaking injury assessment or restoration activity. In addition to that, it's going to be paid for the trust fund. That's probably goes without saying, but they wanted to say it anyway. It also allows the government to change the trustees without objection from the other, so long as neither government designates more than three trustees. It was interesting to me because it looked like a government could designate fewer than three trustees if that government chose. The government could actually give up some of their. That wasn't too clear, but I doubt they would ever do it.
I would like the record to reflect we've been joined by Representative Lawrence also.
This also acknowledges that the President is giving the EPA the task of coordinating the restoration of injured natural resources on behalf of the federal government. That's not too surprising. Section in here that was very interesting to me, and it's because it's probably more of a legal matter of legal fascination than the policy question at all. But it says that the MOA does not constitute an election on part of either government to be bound by the Natural Resource Damage Assessment Regulations, codified at 43 CFR 11. I found that interesting because if you'll remember when I talked about the parties referring to the laws that they thought were controlling, one of the ones that they cited was an assessment regulation. So I didn't know why this section was here. Also, two of the 43 CFR 1192 and 93 talk about where the money is supposed to go. And they were the ones that I talked about earlier, where I said, is this commingling of assets consistent with these federal regulations? And those federal regulations are in 43 CFR 11. They are not, however, damage assessment provisions. So that's a question that I would really like to ask the Attorney General. Do you think that these 1192 and 1193 apply, notwithstanding this section right here? Any questions on that? The next paragraph, I think...
Any questions on that? I realize that some of these questions are very important from a legal point of view, but somewhat technical, and it's my hope and intent that as we proceed here, and as we invite these witnesses to us, that as time permitting, Ms. Findlay and staff will make certain that those questions are asked, and we'll invite them to ask some of these questions themselves.
The next section, I think, is probably also a very important one because it concerns the use of natural resource damage recoveries, the use of the trust fund, and this is really what we were talking about a little earlier. They jointly use the trust fund money to restore, replace, enhance, rehabilitate, or otherwise acquire the equivalent of natural resources injured as a result of the oil spill, and the reduced or lost services. So this section is what puts a limit on what the trustees may use the money for. Unfortunately, the only thing that's defined in the MOA is removal. And as I say, that is a very broad definition. So that while there are some limitations, they can't just go use the money for something that doesn't have anything to do with the oil spill. The limitations seem to me to be fairly broad here. They don't tell you exactly what you must use them for. There are some definitions in the federal regulations that apply here. One of them was that may apply. It's not clear that they apply, but they might apply. They are in this field of law. They have services defined as the physical and biological functions performed by the resource, including the human uses of those functions. And I would interpret that quite clearly as being human uses such as for food or water. I'm not sure that it would include such things as recreation, but it very well might. Restoration and rehabilitation usually means actions undertaken to restore the resource to its baseline conditions. Spill. Under this paragraph, the governments are also supposed to establish standards and procedures for administering the trust fund money. At this point, we may get some narrowing. It may be clearer what they intend to use the money for once they establish those standards or procedures, or are going to get it or not, depending on how specific your standards are. And finally, the paragraph requires that the money be placed in the trust fund. The questions I had about this really have to do, some of them are sort of legal and some of them are quasi-legal. One is, how will the trustees know how much of the trust fund should be spent on damage to state resources and how much should be spent on damage to federal resources? Because we have the money all mixed up together and we don't know whose is whose, how in spending it are you going to separate? Are the trustees going to come to some rough allocation and say, well, half is sort of for your resources and half are for ours, or will they never ask themselves that question? Another thing that I saw as a possible problem here is that the trust fund could be substituted as a funding source for services the federal government would provide in any event. In other words, you have federal officials up here now, they're doing work, suddenly they're all going to be doing restoration work and they're going to be paid out of this budget. How likely is that to happen? Is there any law to stop it, first of all, or are there any more practical considerations to stop it? One of them might be obviously the state trustees, that you have to get unanimous agreement. What are the limits on the acquisition of equivalent resources in practical terms? And this is the example I was using earlier. If you're going to compensate for lost beachcombing, could the trustees build camping sites or ski lodges or roads to ski lodges or swimming pools or who knows what? Another question I had on the administrative end is whether the trust was going to pay its own administrative expenses. I assume it's going to have some. And are those going to come out of the trust fund? Is this sort of a little mini bureaucracy? Or it begins to look that way to me, but there's just a question that I have. Who, if anyone, will perform audits of the trustees' expenditures? This again, in state government, if the state agency is going to be spending the money, the legislature usually has a pretty good handle on what happens to it because of audits. And I'm not sure if this is all done in public, this may not be a problem at all. But it's just something I thought the members of the committee might want to look at, is what kind of auditing function would there be. Also, if the trustees actually buy land in acquiring equivalent, under the acquiring equivalent natural resources clause, then who's going to own it? And if they develop it, who's going to run it? And I expect that that's something that they will have to figure out if they actually decide to do that. Are there any questions on the use of the money?
Any questions by any members of the committee or other members? I'd like to also welcome Representative Hanley, who's been participating with us, and invite him to join us anytime he desires. I do have one question. Representative Barnes has raised the issue in the past, as have several of us, the constitutionality, whether we're giving up, for example, our power to appropriate. And I am also concerned whether that these agreements be examined similarly from the federal point of view. Are they constitutional, or is Congress being removed of its power to appropriate?
Well, on the congressional and on the federal end of things, there are provisions in the federal law that allow the money to be put back in the federal treasury and spent for certain purposes without further appropriation. In a way, what you have just asked is a subset of my question, mm-hmm. Does the money have to go back in this fund?
Mm-hmm.
Once it goes back in that fund, Congress has already sort of given prior appropriation, I might say, prior appropriation for that money to be used for certain things. But since the money's not going back in that fund, then there's that question that does arise.
I understand, but in the congressional sense, this may be that may have been considered quote authorizing legislation, mm-hmm. rather than quote appropriating legislation. We don't need an answer to this now, but because I don't know that one Congress can bind another any more than one legislature can bind another.
I do think there is, to answer the first part of your question, I do think there is a very substantial question on the appropriation issue. If some of this money is state money, then it's going to be spent without appropriation, then have you not, are you not violating the Constitution? That's it. The other interesting thing about it is when it's sitting in the Federal Registry, I suppose one can always argue that the money never really becomes a state asset because it never gets divided up and we never know how much is ours. Then it all gets spent before it ever becomes an issue. But if they can try to move it to another trust fund, then there's the question, well, doesn't the legislature have to appropriate that money to some other fund?
Questions, Representative Barnes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are we on teleconference?
Listen only. We will be on that one.
In the vein of the discussion that you were just having with Representative Greenberg, a concern that I have, if, for example, we passed a resolution ratifying this agreement, would that not then be in effect to ratifying the trust agreement and the way that they were going to spend the money?
Okay. Now this is the question of, does approving the consent decree mean approving the MOA? And I consider that an open question, probably an unanswerable one. The consent decree references the MOA. It says the U.S. and the state government represent that the money will be spent in accordance with the MOA. And you can look at it that as two ways. And if you approve of the consent decree, then you are approving of that representation. You can also look upon that as simply not a promise between the parties, but simply a statement of what they intend to do, and therefore that you are not approving the statement of what they intend to do. I do think probably that if you want to make sure that you are not ratifying the MOA, then you need to say so.
Other questions? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pam, it looks to me like the initial reimbursement of past expenses up to $72 million would clearly flow into the general fund. Is that your understanding?
Yes, that is my understanding, and I checked that with the Attorney General. That is his understanding. The money will come back to the state, and it will be available for any use.
And subject to appropriation.
And certainly subject to appropriation. And that's what both of us think. So if that's any consolation.
Other questions? If not, please continue.
The next section does deal with the reimbursement to governments, the $72 million to the state and the $62 million to the federal government to reimburse for past expenses. The reimbursement money shall be paid directly to the governments by Exxon. It doesn't even flow through the trustees. And it's going to be paid over 5 years. It doesn't say which 5 years. I don't know whether this is the next 5 years, nor does it say in what installments, nor does it say whether the feds and the state get paid equally at the same time, or I have questions about the timing and the amounts of the payments, but at some point the state should be receiving $72 million. Also, all of the governments, the state, or I'm sorry, did you have a question for that on?
Well, I guess it's just something else. I was under the assumption, having read this very clearly, the main document, that this was something that we would be getting up front. Obviously, I was mistaken. So even the money that we've already spent, it takes us 5 years to get it back.
Potentially.
And you could be talking about the last 5 years of this agreement by your statement.
Potentially.
I assume that that's the end. Yes, sir. Questions? Please continue.
All of the government's unreimbursed response and cleanup costs incurred after last December 31 and certified by the federal or state on-scene coordinator will also be reimbursed to the appropriate government, which means that that's why it's hard to tell how much money's going to go into the trust. And that if the federal government decides to do a lot of cleanup work, they can deduct it from the settlement proceeds. If the state decided to do a lot of cleanup work, we could, assuming that it's approved by the appropriate person. The next section is one which bothered me a great deal when I read it. I'm not quite sure what the intent was, and this is very definitely something where we should ask the Attorney General why this is here, because we may be reading it differently than he intended it to be read. But what it says is that except as otherwise provided in the MOA, the trustees agree that the trust money will be expended on restoration of natural resources in Alaska unless the trustees agree that spending funds outside of Alaska is necessary for the effective restoration, replacement, or acquisition of equivalent natural resources injured in Alaska and services provided by such resources. Now, I have two questions. One is more of a technical. Why is this except as otherwise provided language in there? I didn't see any other provision on this, and if there's another one, then we should probably know what it is. But the main question here is, could the trustees establish a recreational site in another state to compensate for the loss of a recreational site in Alaska? That's probably the most extreme one. Could fish hatcheries be built in Washington and paid for out of the trust fund provisions under the theory that some of the fish would migrate up? I don't know quite what the theory would be, or that you couldn't restore them, so that this was the next best thing. Could scientific studies be done out of the state and paid for with trust fund money? The real question I have is, why did they put it in here? What were they getting at? And it's probably unfair to speculate, and I may be taking this farther than it ought to go, but it's a provision that makes me nervous because it does seem to open up the limits that were on the restore and rehabilitate line, which it seems to open that up so that they're not even necessarily going to be located in Alaska or Prince William Sound.
Questions on this provision? And I hope the members understand this is very significant questions like that we have on this. Representative Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, just on the final comment that you just made, you said the expenditure of funds in Alaska, then you said, as a sort of after that, or Prince William Sound, but I just wanted to just let you know that there are damages outside Prince William Sound related to the spill, and just so we all know we're talking about those. Most of them probably within Prince William Sound, but
Kodiak,
Coquimbo also, and perhaps some other areas.
Actually, I'm not sure that the rehabilitate and restoration, they do talk about the resources damaged by the spill, which would include all of the areas. But also, and I was using Prince William Sound generically, I probably shouldn't do that. The Aleutian Islands will get mad at me. But the area by the spill, but I'm not sure that the money, even if it's used in Alaska, would necessarily have to be used in the areas that were damaged by the spill. It would have to be for, if it were going to be used outside that area, it would have to be to get equivalent to replace equivalent resources.
Representative Lehman, have you finished?
Yes.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving back to just for a minute on that reimbursement to government, to governments, something that strikes me is I wonder if there's a correlation between those funds or any of these funds and the use of the 470 fund. What I'm thinking here is that, with my Machiavellian thoughts going on here, whether or not we're setting up a federally controlled fund that essentially would minimize the amount of money that would normally be drawn out of the 470 funds, the nickel barrel funds. You maybe don't have any thoughts on that, but you might just think about that.
It's a very good question. I think it's several people have been concerned about the 470 fund and if money goes in. I think one of the fears was the money would go in and somehow cut off the nickel barrel tax. And all I can say is that the money has to be appropriated to that fund. That even though it says that it's put in an account and then the legislature may appropriate it to this fund, the legislature also may not appropriate it to that fund. That's the way it works. So that you don't have a dedicated fund there. But I would say it's one legislature's way of trying to tell the next legislature what it really ought to do with this money, but it cannot be legally binding because of the constitutional prohibition on dedicated funds. But I think there's probably more to the 470 fund, which is what you're saying. Any more questions on that one? The next provision is the MOA states that it does not obligate the governments to expend money except to the extent funds are appropriated or otherwise lawfully available. And when I looked at that, I thought, well, maybe this is where we're supposed to appropriate the money. That at least when the trustees decide to spend the money, perhaps by having Fish and Game do some work, that they will give the legislature the money for the purpose of these Fish and Game studies. The legislature will then appropriate the money to Fish and Game, or not, if it doesn't want to do it. But that's how the appropriation process, that at least the legislature would be involved somewhere along the line, though not certainly in the initial decision making. I talked to the Attorney General about this, and his initial reaction was that that was not what would happen, that the legislature would never be involved, that the money would just go directly to Fish and Game. And I don't really see how that can work. I don't see how that can work practically, because the money has to get into the federal treasury in order to pay the state workers. And also, I'm not sure that a state agency can accept money just out of nowhere. The legislature can authorize the state agency to accept money, but I don't think they can do it without that authorization. So that would be, and I must say, in fairness to the Attorney General, that was a very sort of informal, off-the-cuff kind of conversation, and he may be thinking about it some more, and so when he comes before you, you might be able to explore that fully, a little more fully with him. But it's a question that's out there. On the other hand, this section may just be one of those little safety clauses reassuring the state that they don't have to pay any more money, so they're not really getting any out of it. Then there's a section here on science studies where the state and federal governments continue to cooperate in scientific studies. This is the one section of the MOA which will survive even if the consent decree falls. See, the MOA terminates if the consent decree terminates. So if either the governments with affairs between them, here the two governments settle their potential lawsuits. The governments agree not to sue each other with respect to the authority of either government to enter into and comply with the MOA, the right of either government to engage in further cleanup under the MOA, and all civil claims one government may have against another arising out of acts or omissions that occurred before the execution of the MOA. What this looks like to me is if one of the governments gets sued by a third party, then the other one has to cooperate with, for instance, fisherman sues federal government, state government has to agree to cooperate with the federal government in the defense of that suit. That's really in paragraph F, they talk about that. In E, that covers the situation where third parties sue both governments, and then again, they cooperate in their defense and they do not assert claims against each other. So that unfortunately, we do have the situation of the state cooperating with the federal government against a state resident, which was one of the questions that one of the members raised. Is that a famous one?
Representative Dinkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Finley on the covenants not to sue. It says the right of either government to engage in cleanup, damage assessment, or restoration activities under the law. So where does that put us regards the efforts, say, of, well, first of all, let me go back and ask. Either government can unilaterally perform a cleanup activity without having to go through any kind of agreement with the other entity? The two governments.
Yeah, this is really outside of the whole trust agreement. Either government can decide to go out and do a cleanup activity, but if there's going to be any reimbursement for that cleanup activity, then it's going to have to be approved by the state on-scene coordinator or the federal on-scene coordinator. It looks to me like the state could approve the state's cleanup, and the feds could approve the feds' cleanup, and that the money would come out of the proceeds.
So we have...
Not out of the trust fund, but out of the basic settlement proceeds, because the trust fund excludes the 72 and 62 million, but it also excludes money for future cleanup. So that gets deducted from any money before it goes into the trust fund.
I guess it's very convoluted and confusing, but you know, we have parallel on-scene coordinating activities, and you know, obviously the federal government resources to go out and do cleanup far outweighs the ability of the state to do that. And I was wondering, you know, if the state, for example, a hypothetical situation here, if the Coast Guard were performing a certain kind of cleanup activity that the state unseen federal coordinator, I mean, the state unseen coordinator felt was unnecessary, where would that put us regards to a disagreement here with the covenants not to sue?
I'm not sure that would really be in the MOA, under the MOA, the right of either government. Let me look at that, because okay, in addition, I'm going back to page 13 of the MOA. In addition, all of the government's unreimbursed response and cleanup costs incurred after December 31, 1990 and certified by either the FOSC or the SOSC shall be reimbursed. Now, this is an interesting provision because it says, in addition, all of the governments, and then it's S apostrophe, and so it's not clear whether those are joint or individual. That's often a problem in all of these agreements, that they will talk, sometimes they will say the governments or either of them, and then it's nice and clear, but sometimes it's not. It's not too clear whether it's going to have to be a joint one or not. Where it leaves you to answer your question is with a question mark as to whether or not this provision is going to prevent you from suing. I had a question as to if the trustees, the six trustees disagree, could the state trustees take that issue to court if the issue is the right of either government to engage in cleanup, damage assessment, or restoration activities? Because we have a covenant not to sue here, but does that mean that you can't go back to the court and say, look, the feds shouldn't be doing this? That's a question. It's a question that I actually wrote down. So
I guess, Mr.
Can't
Chairman,
really answer
it just points to the fact that often when we're examining situations such as this, particularly this settlement agreement, answers to our questions only generates more questions, so it's going to be, I think, very difficult to determine whether or not this is truly in our best interest.
I have Representative Navarre, then Representative Hudson. Anybody else?
Yeah, Pam, you may have already addressed this, but on page 7, or actually on page 6 of your analysis, and on page 14 of the MOA, why would they put that covenant in there not to sue each other with respect to the authority of either government to enter into the MOA? I mean, doesn't that just like point a finger at both of them and say that maybe they're like going around some laws here?
It does raise that question. I think what they wanted to avoid is having the state and federal governments agree to something and then have one of them try to back out of it under the claim that you don't have the authority to do it. If the real question is this going to prevent any third party from going in and saying they don't have the authority? And that actually is dealt with a little bit later I can jump there. Perhaps I ought to jump there because this is the second time that the question has come up. On page 18, there's a statement, page 18 of the MOA, there's a statement that it creates no rights in a person who is not a party to it and is not subject to judicial review except as provided in Article 7. And I can't even find what that Article 7 references to. And the big question I had is, are they trying to prevent a third party from challenging the decision? And can they? To a large degree, I think they potentially, it's possible that they can prevent a third party.
Sure. So I want to see if I'm following. They can prevent someone from entering, a third party from entering under an MOA that they may have questionable authority to enter into anyway.
I'm not saying they can. I'm saying that
that's
they will,
what they're trying
that
to.
That they will make that argument. Now, a court may simply, it's really a standing question is what it is. And in state court, standing is very broad. Almost anybody can sue over a governmental action, in this case. In the federal courts, it's a lot harder to come in as a non-party and become a party to attack something. So all I can tell you at this point is that they'll probably would raise that as defense, and they might or might not win on it. I think there's a very strong public policy argument against insulating an activity, especially if it is beyond the power of the government to enter into. And then you simply say that this agreement, which says that I can't come in and challenge it, isn't valid in the first place because you didn't have the authority to enter into it. That would be my argument if I were representing a third party.
Mr. Chairman, I would say that that's a fairly large public policy question. Mm-hmm.
I would agree. I have Representative Hudson and Representative Kabir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I was looking at this the co-trusteeship issue where we say that it does not affect the rights of a third party under no circumstances. And then we're just talking here on the covenants not to sue where it says that the two parties will cooperate in the event a third party does. Seems to me like that interferes or at least diminishes the rights of a third party to sue.
It doesn't diminish their rights to sue. It does affect how the governments are going to be responding. For instance, what they're trying to say in the no diminishing rights of third parties, especially I think for the native villages, not solely, but under the Clean Water Act, the native villages can also be trustees. They also have trust responsibilities as to their natural resources, and I think they're trying to say that by the state and the federal government's dividing up the money here, we're not going to be affecting the trusteeship of those native villages. But it also would apply to any other third party if someone sues the federal government can't defend on the basis of the MOA. They can just get the state to cooperate with them.
Wouldn't that also, if I might, Mr. Chairman, wouldn't that covenant not to sue preclude, for example, the state from joining in with the third party suing the federal government or vice versa?
Yes.
Okay.
Representative Kabir.
It brings up the question again, Pam, to me of what is the state government, and in my studying of government, we have three co-equal branches of government, and would you say that this is also restricting the legislature's ability to challenge this document or any?
I don't think that the state, you couldn't go in and sue on behalf of the state of Alaska, but the legislature would, I think, in a sense be the same position as a quote, the third party we were talking about. Can the third party go in and sue? Certainly, if the third party can go in and sue, a group of legislators can go in and sue.
It certainly wouldn't stop us, though, from challenging the governor's authority to make this agreement, because that would be really a state-to-state issue. It may still question whether if the court ruled that he did not have that authority to do so, is this section sort of saying that doesn't matter what the court rules because you can't bail out of it because you don't have the authority to do it?
Well, if the agreement isn't valid, then any provision in the agreement isn't valid. So you would be attacking the original overriding validity of the agreement to start with. And if if it isn't, then I mean, the court isn't going to say, at least I certainly hope a court isn't going to say, well, there's a provision in here that says you can't sue, and therefore that you can't even sue to determine whether or not this provision is valid.
Representative Moore, you had a question, I think it was a second question.
No, I would just, I guess, suggesting that if the governor, if the legislature disagrees with this, and the governor and his administration decide to go forward with it in any event, then we still would have the right under our constitution to challenge his authority to do so, right?
I would think so. I mean, I suppose there's somebody going to say you won't, but my very strong feeling would be yes, you would have that power to challenge. It's always true when you have an act. You may not be able to challenge the exercise of discretion, but the basic underlying authority, can you act in this particular way on behalf of the state under the Constitution, that is a question that probably a court's not going to want to turn its head away from.
Yeah, I can't see that under the separation of powers doctrine in the Constitution that we would be precluded from challenging what we see as executive authority.
The only question I have is if you ratify the consent decree, how much are they going to do it? And that's a kind of, it's almost like an estoppel question. If they are linked and if you ratify the consent decree, without, at least in a way that doesn't make it clear that you're not ratifying the law, then are you stuck with it?
To digress for a moment, this is something that we need to just procedurally be clear on. Does ratification or de-ratification, whatever it would be, one or the other, or both, require a bill, or can we do it by a resolution?
You're talking about approving the consent decree.
Yeah.
I think it's the position of the office, we've thought about this question, I think it's the position of the office, that you can, as far as the consent decree simply asks for your approval. It doesn't say how. And there doesn't seem to be any force of law required, so you could do it by resolution. However, if there's an appropriation problem here, and you want to cure that appropriation problem, then I think you are going to need an appropriation bill. And I'm not even positive that you can cure it, because it's going to be received over years, and therefore you might be doing a continuing appropriation, which a superior court has just found violates the dedication of funds provision. You might be able to get out of that under the federal program exception to the dedicated funds provision. It gets a little complex if you're talking about somehow insulating this from attack. But if you're simply talking about what does the consent decree require you to do, I think a resolution is enough.
That had been my thinking. But then, when you, in answer to Representative Navarro's question now, said that certain legal consequences would flow by way in the doctrine you invoked was a doctrine of estoppel. My question is a broader one than that, Ms. Findlay. Can you invoke, or could somebody say, a resolution which simply expresses the sense of the body can be used to have the legal effect of an estoppel? I have serious questions about that. And that's what, you know, everything else you had said tracked up to that point. But a question I'd like to be on the list, and this is an internal question, for the operation of this committee and the legislature, is if we act, not if we act, but if we pass something that is a resolution, can it as a matter of law have an estoppel effect? Or would it require a bill to have an estoppel effect? I don't need an answer to that now. I know that's not an easy question. Other questions? If not, please continue.
The next section is the co-trusteeship as to natural resources. The first part of this seems to be fairly straightforward. It was just for the purposes of oil spill litigation, each government is entitled to assert that it is co-trustee of all the natural resources injured, lost, or destroyed as a result of the oil spill. If they're going to spend the money jointly, then they're obviously going to have to be co-trustees over the resources. However, in addition, there was another little clause that trailed off at the end, which says that each government also agrees not to sue the other one to determine the share of either government's ownership or rights or management authority over natural resources injured, lost, or destroyed as a result of the oil spill. And that didn't seem to be linked to the MOA. I mean, for instance, if there's some question as to whether or not, let's say there's a section of Kodiak Island that was injured by the oil spill. And there's some question as to whether or not the state or the federal government has the right to manage it. Not because they want the, what you want to know is, do we have the right to restore the beach grass, but it's a basic management question. Is this clause going to prevent them, us from litigating with the federal government over management issues as to any land that happened to be injured by the oil spill? And it looks to me like it does that, and I don't, again, know whether that was the intent or not. Certainly, if you're talking about whether the trustees can get together and decide to do something about that, that's a different question. But what I'm worried about is the federal government asserting authority, and we say, no, you don't have authority, that's our land. And they say, oh, well, since this was injured by oil, you can't go sue us about it. The next section, were there any more questions on that? The next section concerns the effectiveness of the MOA. And this, I cannot understand why this section is here at all. What it says is, if the governments become adverse to each other in the oil spill litigation, in other words, the litigation with Exxon, the MOA remains in effect. And then if you turn to the termination provision, it says that it terminates 16 years from the effective date or upon termination of the consent decree being the one with Exxon, unless otherwise agreed by the parties. So if the consent decree terminates, or essentially the court never enters into it, then the MOA would terminate, I would think. But then why would the governments become adverse to each other in the oil spill litigation and still have this thing remain in effect? It's a puzzle to me. I don't know why that is there. It doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. They could agree that it would remain in effect, I suppose, but then why have a specific provision that says that it does?
Are you finished?
Yes.
Representative Kavita?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pam, that is dealing only with Exxon, so we're not dealing here with third-party people at all.
I think they define oil spill litigation as the Exxon litigation.
Well, how do you see the relationship with the federal and state governments and with some, my understanding is there have been lawsuits filed, class action suits filed against the state at the close of last week before the statute of limitations. How do you see, does this affect that relationship between the two? Is there agreement to say that they were going to help each other, mean the federal government is going to help us on that?
Yes. If these are lawsuits where somebody has sued just the state or the state and the federal government?
My understanding is the state, but I could be wrong.
It doesn't make a lot of difference because their basic agreement is that they will cooperate in defense of those lawsuits and that they will not sue each other. In other words, that if the state has to pay out some money to somebody, it will not then go over to the federal government and say, hey, this is really partially your fault, give us some of the money back.
And so, Mr. Chairman, so our understanding is from what we did on the first document, now on this document, nothing changes, that if we are judged in some way guilty or have to pay out a fine to these other suits, say $100 million, $200 million, there is no way in any of this documents that we can get this money to us through this trust.
Yes, you're not going to get it back from Exxon, you're not going to get it from the trust, and you're not going to get it from the federal government. There are some little provisions, I should limit that. There are some provisions that have to do with how ESCO where it might work. But in general, yes, you're not going to get the money back. You have to really look at the $72 million plus the $50 million coming from the fine as the only real hard money that you're going to have to pay for past things and future lawsuits.
Which we may get over 500 in
500.
Okay, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pam, I don't see anything in either the consent decree or the MOA that requires legislative approval of all of this action. I see a reference that if the legislature doesn't approve, they've got 15 days after the public comment period, which either government can withdraw. But it looks to me like what this thing is doing is setting up a fund outside of state government control. And I think that's the whole intent here. And then giving us an opportunity to review it, and if we want to agree to it, fine. But if we don't agree to it, I think the government probably, or the governor may still be able to agree to this. The governor goes in and makes other kinds of agreements as long as they're not involved into public monies, our monies that we control. Is that fair assessment?
I should even make it clearer than that. The MOA does not require or invite the legislature's approval or disapproval. You don't have to approve this or disapprove it or anything. The only reason we're talking about it is because it is somewhat relevant to the consent decree. Now, in the consent decree, the governor has asked, but the provisions say if the legislature does not approve it, fails to approve it within that time period, that 45-day period, then the either the state or the federal government may withdraw.
Right.
They are not required to. And that is just the consent decree. You are not really being asked to express any opinion whatsoever on the MOA. And the MOA will remain in effect except for the... If the consent decree stays in effect, then the MOA will remain in effect. Except there's a provision that the other parties otherwise agree.
Yeah, I have Representative Navarre and Representative Barnes.
Why 16 years? Is there some particular significance?
None that I can think of. They're going to get the money. I think they want to have some period of time after the last payment comes in to spend it. So they wanted to give themselves enough time. But why specifically 16 years, I don't know.
Thank you.
Representative Barnes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Finley, over the last few days, you have done a great job of raising questions and trying to put this settlement into some sort of perspective. But if you can sit down and raise all these questions, which many of them I had to begin with, but you've done an excellent job legally of doing it, would you mind telling me why our Attorney General didn't raise some of these questions?
Well, it's possible he did, and I don't know about it. I can only raise them from my point of view, and you'll have to ask him, one, whether he raised them, and if he didn't, why not?
I think that that's a question that maybe you want to ask the Attorney General.
I think I will.
Yeah. and the point is not lost on anyone in this room. The record should reflect people are nodding and smiling on that one. Other questions at this point? If not, I'd like to go for another couple of minutes, and then we'll break so people have a moment before we go on the floor. Maybe one more provision here.
Okay. Actually, the big ones are pretty much gone. The MOA is enforceable in federal district court, which will change jurisdiction. If the MOA is determined to be invalid, and this to me suggests that they are anticipating some kind of third party out there coming in and saying you can't do this, the use of the remaining money, whatever money hasn't been spent by the trust up to then, will be determined either by further agreement of the governments, they'll make up a new MOA, or by an allocation of the recoveries by the court. In other words, the court will say this is so much as the state's money and this is so much as the federal, if the parties can't agree. On the effective date is the date the consent decree is signed and entered by the court. In other words, this thing isn't effective yet, except for the science studies, which I mentioned earlier, which is effective right
now. Before moving ahead, please, members and others, leave your books here so staff can update them, and they'll get them back to you hopefully by noon or early this afternoon. Please leave your books with Andy and the mayor of that. Go ahead.
On termination, the MOA terminates 16 years from the effective date or upon termination of the consent decree, unless otherwise agreed by the parties. If the consent decree terminates, it seems to me that there wouldn't be any reason for the MOA to stay in effect because there's going to be any money to spend. But I suppose it's possible that they could terminate the consent decree, continue with litigation, and still have the MOA remain in effect by their agreement.
At the risk of stopping just before the end, I'm going to stop at this point here. We will just, I see people are sort of packing up their bags. We will start on provision 11, termination, which you just did, but I want to be sure. And then we'll go into the plea agreement, and then we will go over the list of questions tomorrow so that we know we're in line, and we'll get Mr. Cole here within the next couple of days. Other questions? Again, we're meeting tomorrow at 12:15 in this room between 12:15 and 2. I'd ask members to be prompt, please. Thank you. It is now 10 minutes to 11.
Thanks, Brian. I'll pass that on to you.